Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director for the same project. How are you today, sir?
Dry so far, but we'll see.
It's a little rainy here in Austin as we record on Tuesday late morning, after morning. So, what to say? There's just been a ton going on in the last couple weeks, and in many ways, some of the stuff we kind of have on the bullet list for this week, we could have talked about last week, but we really wanted to kind of take a break and talk about Trump a little bit now.
We're sick.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a lot of intersecting developments in both state and national politics. So today we're going to kind of survey a development or two or three or four. But speaking of Trump, first though, and that's just, look, it's 2024.
Hey.
It's a presidential election year. It is going to be a Trumpy year one way or the other in terms of what we're all talking about. So first, we should add a little Texas angle to what is the dominant political story nationally coming out of the weekend, and that is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis dropping out of the Republican presidential nomination contest, the winnowing of the field to a two-person, air quote, contest, such as it is, between Donald Trump and Nikki Haley with, something of a showdown in New Hampshire today. I mean, it's an interesting heat check without, recapping all the national media stuff. New Hampshire, not really, if you're going to, old comparative politics methodology, if you're going to plug the watermelon to sample it, if the watermelon is the Republican Party, if New Hampshire is the way you plug it, you're not really getting a representative sample of what is going on out there in Republican politics for the main part.
And I mean, just to take, we don't need to go into a lot of detail about this, but it is sort of like, it is interesting how much politics has moved in the last few decades when you look at sort of the role New Hampshire used to play and people talk about it, like, this is where you save your campaign. And we were kind of spending some part of the morning talking about how bad could Nikki Haley lose and still want to go to her home state to lose again, probably?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're talking about here. I mean, it is like, it's not...
Right.
Well, it's not going to save her candidacy or something. I mean, the question is it going to prolong? Is it going to prolong it?
And a good, whereas not quite as, I'd like to think not quite as guilty, but, we're certainly susceptible as everyone else to, overinterpreting what's right in front of us sometimes, right? And so, the last several weeks have been all Iowa, New Hampshire, after Iowa, frankly, I was kind of like, okay, Iowa's caucuses are over. Don't really have to think about that for three plus years.
Right.
There's an element of that to New Hampshire. As you were saying that, and we should say, one of our colleagues, the Jeremy Suri, had dropped by as we were prepping for this, and we were just kind of kicking around what does Haley need to get to go on, I think was kind of the way Jeremy posed it. And now, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, say Nick, and I do not think this is even close to, but hypothetically speaking, say Nikki Haley won New Hampshire.
Right, sure.
How would that actually change the dynamic of the race in the long term? I kind of suspect not much.
Yeah, unless
she would have to go, she would have,
she'd have to go on and win South Carolina.
And it would be harder for her to drop out.
Yeah, she couldn't drop out. She'd have to win South Carolina, which all indications are that she wouldn't. And then she'd have this sort of difficulty of like, well, you won New Hampshire, but you lost your home state and also a southern state, a much more sort of obviously Republican state. And it's probably much more indicative of the way the rest of the contest is going to go.
Right. And then you go on to Super Tuesday, which is, heavily favors Trump.
Yeah.
So, I'm not saying I won't be, you know, watching election returns tonight and keeping track of it. But look, we talked, you know, as far as where this is right now, again, stepping back and, you know, because we talked about it so much last week, we don't need to do it all again. You know, we talked a lot about Trump's dominance in Texas last week. This, you know, he's similarly dominant in most of the states that look Republican.
Well, and to our colleagues, you know, comment about whether Trump's support is strong or weak or whatever. There's a lot of different ways you can look at that.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that's going on sort of in the aftermath of Iowa is to sort of, you know, in some ways, you know, talk about DeSantis's failings as a candidate. And there's been a lot of that kind of going on in the lead up to Iowa about how, you know, he entered with all this great promise and, you know, and in some polls he was leading Trump early on and blah, 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 and all the problem, blah, blah. But you know what? Like, DeSantis was a strong candidate. Like, let's just take a step back for a second here. You know, I mean, I don't mean that he didn't have missteps, but I mean, like, look, this is the whole thing. They did, like, oh, DeSantis, you know, had a problem, you know, connecting with people, or he had missteps. It's like, Donald Trump is your nominee. He is going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. So the idea that these things are in and of themselves, like, you know, the reason that he lost. Look, in our polling, you know, DeSantis was at 62-12 fave-unfave among Republicans. He was only a little bit off of Trump when we were looking at, you know, Republicans, the conservative Republicans. It wasn't as though this was a guy who was going into the race where a lot of Republicans had negative attitudes about him, or even like Trump drove up his negatives. The point is that Republicans had a choice in that race, and a lot of them were choosing between Trump and DeSantis, with Trump the heavy favorite. And when you looked at the second choices, a lot of the second choices for DeSantis would have gone to Trump.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, the way I look at it is sort of like, you can kind of say like, oh, well, DeSantis was like, no, DeSantis was a governor of a very large state, raised a bunch of money, ran a national campaign for the first time against, you know, basically an incumbent. Yeah, you know, we'll see him again.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think so.
I think I'm probably a little less charitable towards DeSantis than that. I mean, I think that
I have been accused of being too charitable to
his numbers on, you know, his numbers on paper, you know, I would leave people say, look, he was a reasonable candidate. But I think, you know, the factor you're emphasizing there, I think, is important, or that's embedded in there, is that, you know, look, DeSantis was the argument.
Yeah.
You know, the central argument of the DeSantis campaign all along was that they could get to the right of Trump in some key areas with more traditional conservative Republican primary voters and offer DeSantis as similar enough to Trump without the baggage.
Yeah, and that assumed that people cared about the baggage.
Right, and that was a fundamental miscalculation. But I also think there is a way in which, and I'd have to go back and look, I'm not sure that Trump didn't succeed in driving up DeSantis's negative somewhat. I mean, maybe not in here, but I think in the earlier states and nationally, I'm just not sure that's the case. But
yeah, I mean, I guess I mean, this is all whatever, matters of degree. I mean, I would just say, you know, I think it's easy to paint DeSantis dropping out as, you know, him being a weak candidate in hindsight or whatever. But I think the reality is he was just a very, very distant second choice in most cases to Trump for most people. And that's how it played out. I mean, what's funny is that Haley is the one who's left, because if anything, you know, at least her numbers in Texas haven't been as strong as DeSantis's throughout, you know, the time we've been polling both of them.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably true generally. I mean, she's kind of starting from a weaker position. I mean,
the most charitable version is, you know, DeSantis, theoretically right guy, wrong time.
Yeah, that's right. That's the most charitable.
But I also, you know, I have a lot of questions that, you know, it does seem to me that the more we saw of him, the less well he played, and the less well he played with his core constituency, and certainly was, you know, didn't have the raw material to move people. Now, you know, maybe nobody does.
Well,
You know, I mean, right. Look, and you know, and the comparison with Haley is that, you know, Haley was and is, well, she's been trying to blur the distinction a little bit more, campaigning from a completely different rationale. I mean, the reason for her race, the rationale was much different. So anyway, like voters across the country, Texas voters certainly don't prefer DeSantis to Trump. And, you know, here we are, he's gone. I have to say that, you know, when he was making sort of nods towards 2028, I find that kind of laughable, but, you know, maybe that's just, I mean, I just don't see it. I see the moment having passed for him. But, okay, so A lot of other things happened last week. So a couple of quick hits before we – where do you want to start?
You know, we'll just jump around real quick, try not to spend too much time on any of this. But, you know, the Fifth Circuit, you know, consistently known as the most conservative appeals court in the country, blocked Texas from enforcing its book rating law, which would have required booksellers to rate books based on the explicitness and relevance of the sexual references in this, you know.
Yeah.
And without going into a lot of detail about this, you know, I think it's notable, again, that the most conservative appeals court essentially sided on, you know, First Amendment and also, I mean, a mixture of both First Amendment grounds, but also the economic consequences of sort of requiring booksellers to come up with these rating systems. You know, I think the thing we just want to point out is, you know, we've been asking a lot about these kinds of questions about, you know, access to books, public school libraries, public libraries, efforts to ban books in Texas. And I mean, without going into a ton of detail here, you know, there's resistance to things that are aligned or adjacent to banning books. You know, there's more of an appetite.
Yeah, it's fair to say, quote unquote, because somebody, you know, somebody will come and say, we're not banning books, et cetera. But,
right.
You know.
That's why I said aligned or adjacent.
Yeah,
I'm not saying,
right.
You know, and that's right. I don't want to be fair here. But, you know, there is more of an appetite around limiting what's available to minors, but it's still not as lopsidedly partisan as we think. The last time we looked in this, about 60% of Republicans were open to basically limiting what books are available to young people in libraries, but 30% were opposed to this idea. And so it's not—
And again, that's Republicans.
That's Republicans. So that's
right.
This is not a slam dunk. When we look at the electorate, and that leads to numbers in the electorate overall, it tends to find a majority of voters sort of against these kinds of efforts to limit, you know, basically book access in one way or another. So that was an interesting thing that happened
right.
Last week.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those things that really carried over. I mean, you know, we pay a lot of attention to these things when they're in the legislative process. You have these arguments. And, you know, it's only fair to note that, you know, there were a lot of doubts about the constitutionality of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going in, and this is going to continue to be debated.
And it was also, you know, to get to where they actually got on that bill took a lot of curious routes and a lot of torturing to kind of decide that this is what they were going to do.
Yeah.
And the fact that it kind of didn't end up, you know, it didn't end up passing constitutional muster, not totally surprised, doesn't mean we won't be back to this at some point later.
Right. And you know, the advocates and the supporters of this, you know, obviously we're not banning books, we're, you know, managing access. I don't think that argument ever completely took, but so what else, you know, what else in the last couple of weeks? Well, you know, big, you know, just in the last couple of days, Supreme Court issued an order. And they, you know, they didn't issue a decision in the case per se, but they issued an order allowing U.S. Border Patrol agents to remove concertina wire placed among the U.S.-Mexico border by the state of Texas, deployed by some combination, I think, of National Guard and DPS, but I think mostly National Guard, but under at the order and at the behest and the order of the governor. You know, this is just taking place among various disputes that have been ongoing between the federal government and state forces. The most recently, access to a park that the National Guard, you know, wired off and restricted access to in Eagle Pass. You know, most importantly, refusing to allow Border Patrol access to the park. Border Patrol, you know, was arguing that essentially this is preventing them from doing their constitutionally designated duty by the time we got to court on this. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that the court issued this order. They're also, you know, reviewing the Texas legislation. You know, they're slated to give a more full hearing to Texas legislation, you know, empowering state enforcement of the on the border and efforts on the border. You know, I mean, it was interesting how in the run-up to this last week, before the court ordered this decision, you know, I got calls, I know you did, lots of discussion in the media about, you know, is there going to be, you know, I mean, I think people had this vision of like,
yeah,
you know, the National Guard and the Border Patrol sort of shooting it out at the border,
yeah,
you know. And, you know, look, I don't want to underplay the significance of this challenge by Texas to federal authority and to traditional constitutional understandings of who has authority at the border and where those lines are. That's interesting. That's going on. But, you know, it speaks something to the, you know, both the nature of media coverage in a generic kind of way, but also the mood around this, how quickly we went to that, in terms of, you know, the kinds of questions I was getting, you know, the discussion, the, you know, the kind of implication in some of these stories and, you know, that I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think, you know, coming on the heels, and we talked about this last week, of sort of Abbott's, you know, pretty unfortunately framed comment about, you know, essentially saying that, you know, we're not shooting, you know, immigrants crossing the border because we'd be charged with murder by the federal government.
Yeah, with the implication being otherwise.
Otherwise, yeah, open season. But I think to the extent that that was sort of the backdrop behind this conflict ongoing in this park in Eagle Pass, and it is interesting because, I mean, my understanding is that DPS is letting, like, other people go in. Like, I could go into the park, apparently, if I just showed up and wanted to use the park. They're just not letting Border Patrol in.
Right.
And the idea here being is that they're not letting them in because the contention that they're essentially making is that Border Patrol is aiding and abetting the entry of migrants. Right. It's an interesting position to take, but I do think, I mean, one sort of, I'm just thinking.
And that was the position taken in Texas filing with the court.
Right. And so that's an interesting position. You know, I mean, ultimately, I don't know what Texas's end game is with this because, you know, I mean, really, it's like either you're going to get what the court to agree that the Border Patrol is aiding and abetting, or you're going to take over responsibility for securing the 1,200-mile border. I mean, like, it's – I'm sorry to say there's a certain amount of theater here, but, I mean, hey, we're all adults. It's okay, you know. The concertina wire thing, I think, is actually, you know, a little bit more consequential in the short term just because if you think about, you know, the way that these stories were trending, to your point, you know, last week, you think about Abbott's comment about, you know, essentially murdering undocumented immigrants crossing the border. You think about, you know, this idea that people have the DPS is now standing there with guns, you know, drawn.
Look, the implication is in order to prevent Border Patrol and federal authorities from helping migrants cross the border illegally.
Right. And so, but to go back, I mean, you know, I think the way that those stories were trending last week was pretty negative for Texas, was pretty, you know, it's probably a little bit negative for Abbott, you know, in some ways, not necessarily with his core constituencies, but I think in terms of the overall direction of the coverage. But now with the Supreme Court saying, yeah, but the feds can go and cut that concertina wire. It's like, oh, so the federal government can go and cut the wire that's keeping out the immigrants?
Yeah, in terms of
something about this that's actually like,
of how you game this out, I mean, I think
it's kind of a save.
Well, it's been a pretty consistent feature. I'm kind of thinking about this as I say it, but I think this is right. You know, it's been a pretty consistent feature of how Abbott and his team have played this issue, in which, you know, the outcome of getting pushback or being, you know, sort of either courts or politically being, you know, pursuing this to its intermediate term logical end, to your point about what's the long term game, you know, tends to break their way.
Yeah. No, right? I think, look, you know, like a lot of policy things, and this doesn't really happen on the border as much, but I mean, you're seeing this here, is in a lot of ways, Abbott is forcing Democratic elected officials at various levels and various ways to take positions that they don't really want to be forced to take. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm a mayor in a liberal leaning, you know, very overwhelmingly Democratic city, and I have to be going out saying, stop sending these immigrants here. Right? Like, I mean, that's not something they want to be doing.
Yeah, no, and that's obviously like exhibit A in how, you know, they did, you know, in stark political terms, they did a good job of kind of gaming this out.
Yeah, and I think this is a further part of this, is to the extent that, you know, the federal government is in the position of wanting to cut the barbed wire, that, if anything, is, you know, that becomes proof of the premise, right?
Right, and if you watch the coverage of this on different kinds of news outlets, you know, there's a battle of the semiotics here, right?
Yeah.
Because on one hand, you know, the argument, so the Abbott, you know, team, Abbott administration has made the argument that, you know, Border Patrol is, you know, now helping people through the wire. So you have, what are the images that get attendant to that, you know, without even doing deep fakes or, you know, using ChatGPT, you know, you have a still image or a little bit of video of, you know, these guys, you know, Border Patrol agents, you know, cutting the wire and, you know, shepherding immigrants through. Now, the other semiotics that you see from the more critical side are, you know, sort of pretty nasty looking injuries, you know, that immigrants are getting. So, you know, there's a basic kind of like, oh, these guys, they've been cut. They're sitting there bleeding. You know, what is our obligation?
Right.
And I don't even mean that in. You could mean that in a big ethical sense. I just mean in terms of you're on the ground.
Right.
You're kind of what we, you know, call first responders or, you know, and, you know, these people sitting there bleeding, you know, depending on where they are vis-a-vis the concertina wire, you know, they might already be on U.S. soil. And so what are you supposed to do? And this, you know, takes advantage of that, and the images work in the way that we're talking about. So, right. You know, I think it's going to, you know, obviously to really step back and thinking about, you know, your question before, your comment before about how this plays out in the long term, you know, Texas loses a lot of these cases.
Right.
You know, we're in, you know, we go to, you know, Texas goes to court, Attorney General Abbott or Attorney General Paxton, you know, get a lot of play in the state and nationally for challenging federal authority in various areas. They go to court. The courts work very slowly. You know, if you think about, for example, voting legislation, you know, you can think of more than one occasion in which the legislatures had to go back and tweak what they've done after the court has told them, the courts have told them they have to tweak it. There's a real long-term, medium-term, or short-term, medium-term, long-term political calculation in all of this, which is that, you know, to my mind, the short and medium term benefits, whether you're going to win or lose in court, are outweighing whatever is going to happen down the road.
Yeah, I
mean, pretty common in politics.
Yeah, but I will say, though, the court process of this is moving a lot faster than it usually does. And partially that's because, you know, you've got Border Patrol with guns and you've got DPS and it's an emergent situation that, you know, requires, you know, an exigent response, right? But yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is, I'll say this, there's no aspect of this I don't think that, you know, the governor and all those in part, you know, all those sort of making these decisions aren't aware of and aren't gaming out themselves. And right now it's looking pretty okay for them. I mean, yeah, that's kind of how I would say.
The politics of that, you know, are work for them.
So a couple other things from last week here.
Yeah. Right?
So, I mean, the DOJ released its comprehensive report on the mass shooting in Uvalde. And, you know, I mean, the main sort of takeaway, I think, that was sort of the headline in the news was, you know, the significant failures on the part of law enforcement in this. I mean, I noticed that the report was like 500 pages longer than the House report, which I thought was, you know, not trying to be that kind of professor. You know,
you're saying size matters, huh?
Sometimes. It's to some people, you know. You know, back in August, we asked people about the factors that they thought, or voters, what they thought were the major factors that led to the sort of the severity of the mass shooting.
And this was August of 22, which was pretty proximate.
Right. Yeah. And what we found was, you know, not surprisingly, you know, 3/4 of voters said it was the delay by police in confronting the shooter. The next highest number was in the 40s, where you saw, you know, flaws in school safety practices, you know, weaknesses in the mental health system and the weapon. But those were all in the 40% range. But 75% of voters basically, yeah, it was the police response. So in some ways, right, affirming what people had already, the conclusion people had already arrived at, you know, doesn't, you know, make a difference going forward. I don't know. We'll see. You know, there has been some movement on the legal front, apparently. You know, a grand jury was impaneled in Uvalde, apparently, but nobody really knows
what's going to happen
or what even they're really doing yet. So that remains ongoing.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was interesting the degree to which, and look, part of this is that this is a little overdetermined.
Yeah.
Right. In the sense that I think there are very few people. It's a relatively rare instance of something with a lot of profile. In which there's a lot of partisan disagreement on the failings of the emergency response, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, I think, and we, you know, we talked about this a bit at the time, and I don't think there's any way to resolve this because the failure was so egregious and is so well documented. And again, to go to the, you know, the semiotics of these things, a theme today, I guess, or at least so far, you know, the imagery really supports this argument. Now, that's not always a good, that can be misleading. Yeah. But in this case, the alignment between, you know, all of this video footage we've got, you know, if you watch the national news coverage when the report was issued on, you know, probably the 6 or 7 instances that I saw, and again, the not random sample, but, you know, across networks and cable, one of the things that you saw, you know, most frequently was the section of the school camera, and I don't think, maybe it might have been one of the body cams, of, you know, one of the law enforcement, you know, officers running down the hall. You know, you see the smoke coming from the shots, and then he runs back.
Yeah,
and that's become kind of emblematic.
Yeah.
Of what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we wrote at the time, and I still think this is out there, but it's just the nature, you know. And again, it's, I think it's fair but unfortunate. You know, we know that the gun, the presence of the firearm that was there, you know, lots of documentation that there was a lot of chatter saying, hey, he's got a high-powered assault rifle. We're going to wait until, you know, various things might happen to make it more safe. Well, it's a pretty big part of this. You know, and but because that folds into the much more human story, I think, of and more apparent, as we said, that, you know, like there was a failure of, you know, strategy, planning, and just a failure to act. And I think that, you know, that makes such intuitive sense to people.
Yeah.
You know, particularly given the evidence. And again, I'm not saying that it's not right. I mean, I think it's right. Mm-hmm. But it really just overpowers, you know, the discussion of anything else that might have, you know, of other things that contributed to this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting way to put it. I mean, I started thinking, you know, and I'm not disagreeing or agreeing. I'm just thinking about what you said. And it is interesting to consider the fact of, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, like the school safety practices and whether the doors were locked or not and the organization or disorganization of the incident command. And sort of
something that was relatively newer and more detail on this and
the triage process,
medical response is really a horrible part.
I don't want to talk about it, but... But the thing about that is, you know, you sort of have to take a step back and say, you know, in a situation like that, you know, you can understand why a person might be inclined to say, oh, that door is locked. And why someone else might say, oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, with basically, you know, the smoke flying, the high power, you know, all of a sudden it's like, are you going to jiggle your keys?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this is the thing. People become motivated to see what they want to see, to believe what they want to believe. And, you know, even in a situation like that.
Right. And I think in this case, what it's done is that, you know, it hasn't led to anything that I think is fundamentally misleading, but it places coefficient, negative and positive coefficients on certain things.
Yeah, for sure.
Certain elements of the explanation. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, we're getting down to, we're trying to talk about this in the dorkiest way possible, but I 100% agree with the way you're thinking about this. And that's exactly, I was avoiding talking about it that way, but yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of correlation between these factors, and it takes a little bit of disentangling to think about what really was doing what here. But yeah, I mean, you know, you're right. It is one of those things. It
kind of comes up at a, you know, it's kind of come and gone pretty quickly as a story. I mean, it was a big story last.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, we've heard, you know, Roland Gutierrez's campaign, of course, in the Democratic Senate primary, you know, has tried to use this to sort of move their issues back to the center, or center of the discussion, you know. And I think so. What else did we see? We can move on from that. We got another couple things on the bullet list. Yes. You know, campaign finance reports came in last week. Mm-hmm. A lot of, you know, people looking at lots of things there.
A lot of things to look at.
You know, right? You know who? You know how much money is being raised in these House races? Mm-hmm. Particularly on the Republican side, who's spending money, who's not spending the money now, and what does that mean? Does it mean they're probably sitting on it for the last, you know, to avoid it being reported in some cases? You know, the thing that really, the element that really kind of made news was this, the campaign finance report from the governor, right?
Yeah. So, you know, in amongst sort of 19 million or so brought in during the reporting period, about 6 million of that donation, this is to the governor, came from a single Pennsylvania businessman who's apparently a big school voucher proponent. And that was sort of, I mean, it was notable because one, it was, I think, the single largest, you know, one-off kind of contribution in Texas history. You know, it sort of goes into the list of sort of Abbott, you know, mega donor kind of instances that people talk about. But it's also notable because it led to a lot of people asking questions. So is that $6 million going to go straight into House races?
Against, does that get earmarked?
Yeah, is that earmarked basically to go after, you know, basically the Republicans who voted against a voucher plan, right? Because, I mean, I was sort of doing some quick math this morning. You think, you know, like about 26 divided, you know, $6 million divided by 26, about 230,000, you know, a pop. That's a lot of money to potentially drop on, you know, the carpet bomb a campaign in the last week if you wanted
to. Right, try to move a lot of things at once.
You know, so, yeah. I mean, this is one of those, I mean, like a lot of this right now, it's kind of a wait and see. Wait and see what he does. Wait and see how much he spends. But, I mean, I think people, you know, are reasonably looking at it and thinking, you know, he could spend $6 million on those 20 races and just, you know, go crazy.
Well, and remember, you know, he's also endorsing a lot of incumbents.
Right.
Including incumbents that voted for vouchers, so that could also wind up being...
You look for the good side of human
nature. For
some
of those guys. Well, I don't know if that's the good side or the bad side. You know, I'll tell you what, it's good for the governor if you said, okay, here's a big pot of voucher money. You know, that means that's money, non-voucher money you don't have to spend to defend some of these incumbents and still get the credit for it.
I mean, I've been road test this idea. We'll move on from this in a second, but I'll say it here. I don't think I said this last week, but I'll mention this again. I mean, I think that's a good point. And I think it would be wise for the governor to shower that money in both directions if he's planning to. And part of it, I mean, just to say, like, you know, if he does, we were to take, you know, the fire and brimstone approach and say that $6 million is to go after, you know, those Republicans who didn't support me on vouchers, he's not going to bat, you know, 1,000, right? Some of those guys are going to come back through. And now all of a sudden, you know, you've got people looking at the governor who seems to hoover up like a huge amount of money in the state, who's now taking, you know, again, donations basically from out-of-state businessmen earmarked to basically go after incumbents in his own party. You know, that I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it does create the environment that allows for somebody to say, hey, you know, maybe we should put some limits on this.
Yeah.
I know. All I'm saying is it creates the possibility of the environment. It doesn't mean that that's what happens, but there's a popular narrative out there that campaign finance reform happens when there's some kind of scandal or something.
Right.
And that's not really when campaign finance reform happened. Campaign finance reform happens when the out party and enough of the in party don't like the way resources are getting distributed. And that's all I'm saying. I mean, it's sort of the dynamics are kind of setting up in a way that if Abbott's not careful, he is going to give a lot of people a reason to say, you know, Texas is a limited government place. You know, does the governor need to have $37 million in his bank account when he's not up for reelection? Let's say,
What I would say in terms of pointing to recent.
I'd also add Patrick taking the $3 million before the Paxson trials, another sort of recent example here of, you know.
Yeah, problematic
optics.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm just.
I mean, you know, I think the last time that somebody kind of pursued this along those lines and thought that, you know, and I think it was based on that kind of an argument was, you know, the Lyle Larson legislation trying to, and it was a very comparatively mild.
Very mild.
You know, trying to, you know, limit the time that contributors could be, you know. Mm-hmm. Appoint, you know, become gubernatorial appointees and things like this.
Sure.
And that would be Lyle Larson, who's no longer in office.
He was very much out on an island when he did that. I mean, on that issue and in general, right? And then Abbott ended up challenging or ended up spending money against him and a couple others in that cycle. But I mean, here's the thing. I mean, look, it worked that time. I mean, the sense that Abbott basically made very clear that, like, okay, you can pursue that kind of approach with me, but I'm going to veto it. And also, you should know, like, I'm going after you.
Right.
But the thing is, at this point, you know, it's one thing to say I'm going to go after 3 members. It's another thing to say I'm going to go after 20, 23 members, 30 members. It's another thing to say I'm going to do that. And also, by the way, I'm going to get a $6 million check from some out-of-state business person specifically to go after you. Right. I mean, it's changing the calculus a little bit versus, you know, Lyle Larson on his way out, you know.
Well, I don't know that Lyle Larson was on his way out purposefully when he did that.
No. Well, no. I mean, he was practically, but that's a different question.
He had defined himself as kind of, you know, obviously not on the reservation.
Yeah, exactly. Which is harder and harder to do. Okay.
I'm skeptical, but we'll see.
No, I'm not saying it's going to. I'm just saying it's interesting. It's an interesting set of conditions to my mind. You know?
Sure.
I mean, because ultimately, it is up to the legislature. I mean, the legislature does have the power to change the dynamics of the way this works, and they could. And if you're a House member, nobody's writing you a $6 million check.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Okay.
But if you're in the Senate, then they've written Dan Patrick a check. It's not moving through there anyway.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this, too. So that's right.
Unless Patrick, you know, I mean, there's a lot of questions there.
There's a question about Patrick's piece of that. I mean, I think the other thing about this is you wonder, I mean, this is where I start to wonder, we haven't talked about this, but about, you know, let's say those senators who might have feel like they got, feel as though they're getting squeezed either on the Paxton stuff or on other things looking at Patrick and also feeling the same kind of way about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, I'm just saying there's some conditions out there. I'm not saying they get activated. It's just interesting to look at.
You know, I mean, I think that, it would require a kind of perception of interest along the lines you're talking about and also some, you know, risk aversion.
Yeah.
That I'm not – or some, you know, some risk insensitivity that I've not seen in evidence.
Oh, well, no. No, none of that.
But, you know, things could change.
Yeah.
So to wind up, one of the biggest stories on the ground in Texas from the last week or so from a very Texas-centric perspective
right.
Also intersects both Abbott and the Texas primary, GOP primary. And, you know, after the Texas Supreme Court last week ruled against AG Ken Paxton's efforts to avoid having to give testimony under oath in the ongoing and the whistleblower's ongoing lawsuit against the AG, Paxton announced that he would no longer contest the facts of the whistleblower lawsuit and was, you know, I think in their words, prepared to accept a judgment in the case without further litigation, which was, I think, an interesting kind of way to pose that. You know, in effect, Paxton's office has officially kind of abandoned the denial that was at the heart of part of his impeachment trial defense, which is that, you know, denying that he violated the Whistleblower Act. He's now essentially saying, you know, we're going to stipulate those facts to try to make this, you know, go away. And, you know, the statements on social media and the official statements and the statements of his defenders all tried to play that in a different way, that this was really saving the taxpayers more money.
Right.
I've got more important things to do. I've got to go continue suing the federal government and
right.
fighting the fentanyl epidemic, et cetera. You know, but in the end, this seemed like a, you know, Paxton got put in a box, and it was a pretty stunning turn of events in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think for anyone who watched, you know, the trial closely, you know, and we acknowledge all throughout it was not a legal, I mean, I said the trial in the Senate, it was not a legal trial, it was a political trial, and it felt like it,
right.
and it read like it, and it looked like
laid out in a legalistic way that ultimately helped him. But
right,
yeah.
And yeah, it was legal when it was helpful for it to be legal,
right.
and it was not really so much when it didn't need to be. But, you know, if you spent, you know, at least part of the summer watching that, the idea of going from, you know, sort of this full-throated, you know, not only, you know, I would say, it's not even a saying that, you know, defensive actions, but endorsement of actions, saying, you know, if anything, what was going on by the whistleblowers was a coup, you know, was, and in fact, not only was it, you know, in his right to fire
right.
these people, you know, he was legally bound, you know, he was legally able to do so. In fact, he should have fired them, right?
Right.
And then you go from that to, well, we're not going to contest the facts as the whistleblowers lay them out.
Yeah.
And basically, I mean, it's hard not to connect some dots here. I mean, I think the fact that the Supreme Court earlier in the week said, look, you know, any effort you're going to have to shield yourself and your top deputies from testifying under oath in a real court of law,
right?
We're not going to do that. And the fact that a few days later they say, okay, well, then you know what? We're going to take our ball and go home. Tell us how much this costs.
Sure makes it seem like they're trying to pay their way out of it, or, you know, buy their way out of it. And they even admitted, look, it inevitably, you know, raised the discussion of, well, do we think that the settlement number is going to go down?
Well, it's got to go up.
And
I mean, that's
right. And so that means, and so do we think when the legislature was unwilling to pay the previous amount that they're now going to want to pay the other amount?
Yeah. I mean,
seems like, you know, and so, you know, just in terms of getting some of the, you know, so as of now, the judge in the case has set a date for Paxton to testify, which is well before the primary, February 1st.
Right.
And with dates for whistleblower testimony, you know, about a week and a half period after February 1st.
So there's sort of two things going on here, and I think it's probably worth trying to separate them, at least for the discussion and just, you know, think for thought, right? There's the actual process of this trial and, like,
yeah.
what happens, right? I mean, you know, ultimately, they could go back and negotiate a settlement. Again, I would be shocked if it wasn't a higher number than the $3.3 million.
Yeah, no, it would have
to be,
yeah.
It has to be, right? They can go forward, you know, with the trial and have the judge set it or whatever. I mean, again, we're not lawyers, but there's that whole piece of it. And your point, I think, is right. You know, I think there is a funny part of this if you're Ken Paxton and his allies. Like, yeah, okay, we'll just kick this back to the legislature and let them deal with it next session and see if they'll pay it, right? And have them deal with it or not. But there's another piece of this, which is this is attached to the primary. And what's interesting is to the extent that, you know, Paxton has gone on his variously described air quotes revenge tour against the many, many House Republicans who voted for his impeachment, it does raise the question of, like, whether that effort stands.
I mean, how much does this take the air out of that balloon?
I mean, because it does seem to me that at this point, I mean, again, you're speaking about the social media response. I mean, the social media response from, you know, some of the House managers of the impeachment trial, and,
well,
among others, was pretty, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't even just social media. I mean, you know, the investigating committee issued a statement
right.
under, you know, Andrew Murr's signature, the chair, that was pretty scathing.
Yeah, I mean,
and put all these things together. And again, nobody should be surprised by that. But.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that was remarkable about this from the jump was, you know, the fact that, like, it was, they clearly violated whistleblower laws. I mean, that was sort of, that was seemed the most obvious piece of this, you know, kind of just from the basic fact pattern. As much as that was pushed back against in the impeachment trial, the fact that, again, now we're in an actual trial and they're just saying, no, that happened, is interesting. But then the question becomes, you know, again, from what I've been following of some of these local races and what I've seen kind of in the press coverage, it's not as though the challengers to these incumbent Republicans aren't leaning heavily on the Paxson piece. It seems like that from what I've seen. And again, I can't speak to all the races. I can only speak to the ones that I've seen coverage of. But when I that's kind of what I'm curious about is how much are these candidates, you know, is the Paxson endorsement and the impeachment vote, is it part of a broader package challenging incumbents, or is it the main rationale? And it seems in a lot of cases more like it's the main rationale. And it seems like that rationale has just been totally popped.
Yeah.
Because there's an easy response if you're an incumbent. Say, they're not, the state of Texas is under Ken Paxson's direction. The state of Texas is no longer even contesting that they didn't fire the whistleblowers.
Well, I guess the question I have, and I don't, you know, and I don't think the coverage necessarily, to be fair, I don't think the coverage necessarily helps us with this. You know, you may have some candidates trying to unseat incumbents that voted against Paxson.
Yeah.
Who saw this as an opportunity,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, whether the rationale for taking this opportunity is how much of that is the public face of these campaigns, I just don't know. You know, and you know, look, we've been talking about, you know, we've polled on how much are people paying attention to this. And, you know, the results seem like, you know, this is, people have heard about it, but it doesn't seem, you know, amazingly salient. You know, the public opinion data that we have is, I think, ambiguous on this as well.
Yeah.
It's not entirely salient. You look at Paxton's job approval numbers. They've recovered to a mediocre point.
Yeah.
Among Republicans. You wouldn't call him weak.
No.
You know, and so, you know, when I say, you know, have they let the air out of the balloon? I'm still not sure how much air was in this balloon to begin with in terms of actual voting decisions. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, as we well know, I mean, if you strategize to use this as an opportunity to recruit and incentivize and attract funding for challengers to incumbents, you know, that does a lot of lifting.
Yep.
And that's a, you know, so the balloon is, you know, there's a balloon there to torture the metaphor. But, you know, it still seems to me a little vague over just how much, you know, this is really driving voting decisions. And it's hard for me to imagine this helps in any way.
No.
I just don't know if it hurts, how much it hurts. You know, maybe, you know, we can, you know, we're talking about ways to try to figure this out, right? In terms of polling, but even that, you know, it's difficult.
Well, and you know what the thing is,
particularly at the level of a House race.
To your point, I don't think it has any sort of major impact either way. I mean, the question is, you know, sort of the possibility of it helping and hurting in some sort, to my mind, in sort of a bank shotty sort of sense. You know, to the extent that there are some candidates out there challenging incumbents whose total, you know, reason for running is the Paxson vote, and that's the opportunity that led them to run, and, you know, this is what they're going to base their candidacy around. You know, look, that probably has an impact because you're an incumbent. You have a ready-made answer now at this point, you know, to the extent this comes up. Now, at the same time, you know, one of the things I keep thinking about is these funding questions. You know, a lot of people have pointed out that, you know, two things kind of come out of this. You know, one of the things that I think is interesting is that, you know, Paxson, you know, looking at campaign finance reports, Paxson spent a ton of his available cash on his legal defense.
Right.
And so, you know, at least as where Paxson stands at the moment, he doesn't have a ton of money to throw around in these races himself. So, I mean, he can throw around his own endorsement. He can go and do events.
Yeah. And he's been doing, you know, both of that.
Right.
Both of those.
Of course. You know, the other sort of related development, and none of this is determinative, and I'll say why in a second, is the Defend Texas Liberty PAC, which was sort of his big backer, has been notably quiet thus far in primary season. Now, part of that has to do with their dalliance, if you will, with neo-Nazis and sort of the bad press that came out of that. It's also hard not to wonder how much of that is also related to the fact that, you know, when once Paxton says, hey, I'm not, you know, contesting this, whether they want to pull back in terms of how much money they're going to spend. Now, at the same time, as we've already pointed out, excuse me, it's very possible that, you know, if you think about the funders behind Defend Texas Liberty Act, you think about Ken Paxton's biggest funders, they can spend as much money as they want. They can spin up an operation very, very quickly. And if they want to spend, you know, $100,000, $200,000, a couple hundred thousand dollars in the closing days of a campaign to say that someone's not sufficiently conservative or someone voted to impeach Ken Paxton, there's not enough money or time for incumbents to really respond to that in any sort of serious way.
Well, that's the campaign chess game, right?
And that's campaign chess game. And so we kind of have to just wait and see.
Yeah, you've got the other, other elements out there. I mean, there's a lot of countervailing factors. I mean, I think, a couple things about, we've been talking offline about this Defend Texas Liberty spending question. You know, the other thing to remember is that, there's a lot of countervailing factors here.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, who's using who here?
Yeah.
Right. In terms of Paxton and Defend Texas Liberty. Defend Texas Liberty has a lot of other irons in the fire other than Ken Paxton.
Yep.
Right. And not that they, he's, their guy and all this kind of thing. But, a lot of other things going on in that they're interested in. And also remember, there's a few more, a little more than two dozen, I think, give or take, candidates in which Abbott and Paxton are on the opposite side.
Right.
And, look, this, again, varies from district to district, and it varies a lot, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
All things being equal, if you ask me if I'm a House member in a close race, would I rather have Abbott's backing or would I rather have Paxton's backing right now? I think you'd rather have Abbott.
I would 100% agree with that.
Right. And so, at some point, where the rubber meets the road here in the last couple of weeks. Again, a lot of things we don't know here. That's why we have these elections, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about a very small subset of the electorate. And very small, very, very small electorates in these individual races, where, like your average, about 15,000 votes or something in these races. If you have people who are really ginned up, you're looking at 25,000, maybe a little more,
Well, and that's one of the things about this, we say things are endogenous, again, when it ends, no matter what happens, we're going to hear claims by everybody about how they were the deciding factor, how they're so powerful. I mean, one way or another, you'll hear about Abbott's role in the primary or Paxton's role in the primary or, how the true conservatives spoke up. And whatever, and there's two things. Is that one, it's almost certainly the actual picture is going to be much, much muddier. But two, when you look at someone like Abbott, who has so much resources, he is, again, we're talking about those last minute buys, right, in the chess matches. But what's not going on? Polling. And that's not going on last minute. What's going on right now is the polling. And so ultimately, they're not going to play in races where they're not going to have the impact that they want to have,
and
or they don't have
the
chance to.
There's a lot of polling going on in these House races being done by, interested parties that we're not seeing publicly, or at best we're seeing, and this hasn't really started quite as much that I've seen, but in the next couple of weeks, we're going to start seeing a lot of, leaked campaign polling.
Right. And so the thing is when you start to see
selectively released, I shouldn't even say
selectively released. And so exactly. So I think, once we start seeing, where does Paxton really put in effort? Where does he start really doing events once we get closer to those elections? Where does Abbott really start spending money, start, putting ads out? Ultimately, that's not a random subset. It's not even going to be all of the potential targets. It's going to be the targets where they know that they've got the highest probability of success, so that afterwards they can say, see, look, I was right. The voters are with me. But they're not going to necessarily go and just, scattershot every possible race and see which ones they can get, because, they're smarter than that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everyone's going to have probably a lot more confidence in targeting rather than random strategy. Right. Now,
but this,
I would say that may or may not be right.
But I think this but I'd say this, this is important. I mean, knowing the type of people who listen to a podcast like this, I think it'll be really interesting, after the fact, and thinking about, how this gets covered. If Abbott goes and says, yeah, look, I knocked off four incumbents, and you want to say, how many races did they spend more than $20,000 in, or whatever the threshold is? Oh, did they spend, did they spend that in 20, 30 races and they knocked off three? Then you might, come to a different conclusion than to say, oh, wow, you knocked off four incumbents.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, what you'll see is what we see all the time is, the selection of the denominator that most benefits them when they're looking at their, you know, at their success rates. And, you know, so with if the normal pattern holds, there isn't that much turnover, maybe a little more just based on there being a larger universe.
Right.
You know, you're going to see the defense of pro-voucher incumbents folded into the success rate.
Exactly. And I think the point here is that, you know, because of that window after the election, you have this period where, you know, the election occurred, you get some results, you know, the interested parties start, you know, basically tallying up all the wins that they feel like they have, right? So they can make that claim. But we're still waiting for the campaign finance report. We're still waiting for the final vote data. And those stories get written. And then about a week or two later, you can start to say, well, actually, wait a minute.
Right.
You know?
And by that time, the audience for that story is, you know, a pretty small.
Yeah. And so this is to say, you know, my only prediction here is to say, you know, expect it to be muddled and muddy, but that's on purpose. And expect, again, I think everybody to claim victory.
And I should qualify that. The public audience is pretty small, but it's the kind of thing that insiders will be looking at to handicap, you know, what the balance power is between different ideological sectors, different interest groups, different factions in the House and the Senate. But still a lot to develop on there. So with that, thanks to Josh for being here. Thanks to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. You can find data we talked about, past podcasts, lots of posting by Josh and I in various combinations at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thank you, of course, for listening. Keep in touch, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.